has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Attention all squad, the suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Officer J.D. Tippett, 38 years of age, was killed today.
The entire area has been blocked out, no one allowed in or out, as the search for this would-be presidential assassin continues in downtown Dallas.
The Dallas Police Department arrested a 24-year-old man, Lee H. Oswald, in connection with the slaying of a Dallas policeman, J.D. Tippett, shortly after President Kennedy was assassinated.
Here comes Oswald down the hall again.
You fire that rifle.
That's as fast as you people have been given, but I emphatically deny these charges.
Did you kill the president?
No, I have not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about it was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question.
You shoot the president?
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
Did you shoot the president?
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in Missouri.
What time is it?
I'm just a patsy.
The president?
Chief, do you have any concern for the safety of your prisoner?
No. I don't think that the people will try to take the prisoner away from us.
We went out by Captain Prince. There is the president. There is Leon Wall.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. Well, there's a man with a gun. Absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot.
Mr. Oswald died at 1:07 our time in the operating room of the gunshot wound which he had received.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. In 1990, Ricky Don White, a 29-year-old, unemployed, oil equipment salesman from Texas, publicly claimed that his late father, Roscoe Anthony White, a former Dallas police officer, was part of a three-man CIA hit team that assassinated President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963. White said his father had been recruited into covert operations before joining the Dallas Police Department.
Well, he was chosen for the fact that he was involved in an assassination group in the Philippines from 1960 to 1962 and had came to Texas for a foreign affairs assignment, at which we really don't know what that really comes into detail, but at that time, and somewhere in 63, he gets his first orders to eliminate a national security threat.
Roscoe White joined the Marine Corps and was sent to Japan in August of 1957. While stationed at Otsuki, he reportedly worked on matters connected to the U-2 project, a high-altitude reconnaissance program. This detail is often highlighted because Lee Harvey Oswald was also stationed at Otsuki during his Marine service, though no verified evidence confirms the two men knew each other. Roscoe White would join the Dallas Police Department in September 1963, just 2 months before the assassination of President Kennedy. His tenure at the Dallas Police was short. He left the force not long after the assassination. His timing is one of the reasons conspiracy theorists later focused on him, though no official investigation ever identified him as connected to the crime. During a news conference on August 6, 1990, at the JFK Assassination Information Center in downtown Dallas, Ricky White said his late father, Roscoe White, joined the Dallas Police Department 2 months before the November 22, 1963 assassination so he could carry out the murder of JFK.
Almost 3 years since Ricky White of Midland stood up in a room full of reporters at the JFK Assassination Center in Dallas. He had a story to tell, a revelation, that would not only lead every TV newscast in Dallas that evening in August of 1990, but would be the attention-grabbing headlines in newspapers the next day. Ricky White made a startling announcement that would pique interest across the country, that his father was involved in the death of President John F. Kennedy. As cameras clicked away, he told his story, that his father, Roscoe Anthony White, was a CIA operative posing as a Dallas policeman, and was one of three gunmen that fateful day when the president's motorcade passed through Dealey Plaza in Dallas.
According to Ricky, Roscoe White allegedly used the CIA codename Mandrake and was stationed on the famous grassy knoll in Dealey Plaza. Two other operatives, codenamed Lebanon and Saul, were positioned in the Texas School Book Depository and the County Records Building overlooking Dealey Plaza. Just as a side note here, a spent .30-06 bullet casing was found on the roof of the Records Building by a maintenance worker in 1975. Lee Harvey Oswald, Ricky claimed, never fired a shot and was set up. He described Oswald and police officer J.D. Tippett as, quote, patsies. Watt said that his father and Tippett picked up Lee Harvey Oswald following the assassination, although Officer Tippett apparently had no knowledge of the assassination or the plot. Watt said the plan was to drive Oswald to the Redbird Airport, but somewhere along the way, Oswald panicked and got out of the car. Tippett apparently became suspicious and told Roscoe White that they would have to go to the police headquarters for questioning. At that point, White shot Tippett, Ricky said. Quote, I know he had to live with it the rest of his life because J.D. Tippett was a close friend of the family, end quote. Roscoe White's pastor at the time of the assassination, the Reverend Jack Shaw, was also at the press conference in 1990. Shaw said Roscoe White discussed the assassination with him on several agonizing occasions, including a last conversation on his deathbed. Shaw said he believes Roscoe White, who died in an industrial explosion fire on September 23, 1971, was killed by a witness elimination team activated after Kennedy's death. White had resigned from the Dallas Police Department in 1965. Roscoe White was only 34 years old when he died. Roscoe White's wife, Geneva, told Shaw of overhearing her husband and Jack Ruby discuss the assassination plot. She also overheard them discuss how White had to kill Tippett and Ruby would kill Oswald at police headquarters.
In a meeting with Geneva about 3 years ago, some things came back to her memory that she shared with me. She said that they were down at Jack Ruby's place, and Roscoe and Jack Ruby were in this room talking, and she was overhearing the conversation of the plan to assassinate President Kennedy. Oswald was a patsy.
Ricky White and several other assassination researchers characterized Roscoe White as a CIA operative who had committed several other killings at the government's request. White said he was shocked to learn in 1978 from a family friend who had worked for U.S. intelligence that his father had been a covert U.S. intelligence operative who used the codename Mandarin. The friend also warned that it would eventually be revealed that Roscoe White had been involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Now, Ricky, let's start off with you. You say your father killed John F. Kennedy?
That's correct.
Tell us how you found out.
Well, it's taken several years. I was told in 1978 by a real good close friend of my father's. And it took me by a real surprise and rejected it, walked away from it until 82. I'd found a diary, and then 85, I got the time to really paid attention to be able to really read it. And in his diary stated where he was involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Now, you had been told prior to finding the diary that your father was involved in the Kennedy assassination, hadn't you?
Yes, that's correct.
What was your reaction at that time?
It was shocking. I mean, it took me by surprise. I was working at Camel Soup at the time, and it really took me by surprise. I really didn't believe it and didn't give it any credibility because the man didn't show me any facts. He just told me a story. It really never added up 2 and 2 for the fact that the House Select Committee investigated my family from 1976 to 78. None of that really ever added up until I had gotten older and had realized that all of this was connected to my father.
Fast forward ahead to 1982, Ricky White found his father's diary that detailed plans for the assassination. It called for Roscoe White to go to work for the Dallas Police Department in September 1963. In the diary, White outlined a plan involving 3 gunmen in Dealey Plaza in Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald was not one of these men who fired a total of 6 shots. The diary also contained photographs and documents suggesting CIA involvement in the assassination. The diary also contained Roscoe White's admission that he, and not Oswald, killed Dallas Police Officer J.D. Tippit during the manhunt for the presidential assassin. Tippit was a friend of the elder White's and an unwitting accomplice in the plot, he said.
He was a police officer for the Dallas Police Department, and I come across a part in the diary where it stated that him and 2 other men were in a part of the assassination. It started out that him himself was Mandarin, was located behind behind the stockade fence, and that Lebanon was in the 6th floor book depository.
That would be Oswald.
No, Oswald was not one of the shooters in the Kennedy assassination. Oswald was probably in the book depository, but was not one of the shooters in Dealey Plaza. Saul was on the top of the records building, and what they had was a triangular shooting fire at the motor cave.
Ricky White said the diary mysteriously disappeared from his home in 1988, shortly after he had shown it to the FBI agents in Midland, Texas.
Another question that, of course, has come to mind, and it's been on the minds of many people, Ricky, is where is the diary now? What happened to it?
Well, in May of 88, the FBI was contacted by a gentleman named Al Shorey, which was the district attorney here in Midland, Texas. I had gone to him on the fact of trying to get into a safety deposit box at Woodward State Bank, which is Continental Bank now, and get the proceeds to be able to get into the safety deposit box. Because when I had contacted them, they said that I needed a probated will and a proof of death to get into the box. So I went to Al Shorey for this help, and through his involvement with me in about 2.5 months, had gotten pretty spooked and had called the FBI in. And at that time, they came to my house to obtain the safety deposit box that I had spoken to Al Shorey about. Not knowing that they were coming, I'd have the diary and all the other material laid on a pool table inside my house where I was researching this on my own time. And so when I had gotten to work, they had called, Al Shorey had called, and so did the FBI, and told me that I needed to come home. And I went home to where I'd met with them and had confrontation on the out the front over the fact that I didn't think that they had the right to come into my house. And Mr. Butler, one of the FBI agents, had read in a federal book where if I didn't, and with withholding any evidence in a national case like this, I could spend 10 years and $100,000 fine. And I had gone in and called my attorney, which he had represented, and told me that he thought that I ought to let him in. So I let him in, and we went in there, and they asked me if I had a box, and I did. And we took all this material and had loaded up into the box and had taken it out to my car. And then I had no earthly idea at that time that there was a federal office here in Midland, Texas. I didn't know that they were here, and they said that, you know, at that time, that when I had answered them where we were going, they said the Midland office. And after 5 hours of explaining them the same story I'm telling now, and rejecting me and calling it a hoax and pretty well beating me and browbeating me and very upset me very much. And I was in there in the room when I had loaded all this stuff up. And there were two tables in there, one table where they were sitting down and writing my conversation down. And one desk table is where we were sitting, where there was a speakerphone. And one of the, there was a man on that speakerphone that which was answering me questions too, which was a senator probably from, he had mentioned something about Pennsylvania. And at that time, I loaded all this material up into this box after they had gotten finished with me and had followed me downstairs and put it in the car. And I remember loading everything up in the box, the diary, everything. And they had made copies of everything of the material that was on the desk besides the diary. And they had loaded it up, and I had gone home. And I'd taken the box out and had put it in there in the pool table and had went in my bedroom to where I laid down on the bed and started crying because I didn't know where I was going to go with this story now because I didn't think anybody would believe me.
In March 1989, White contacted officials of the JFK Assassination Information Center in Dallas who were interested but unconvinced of his story. Their inquiry picked up speed in June of 1989 when White said he found hidden in his grandfather's home in Paris, Texas, a metal cylinder containing his father's Marine Corps dog tags and three coded intelligence messages that referred to a directive to carry out the assassination. One of the messages, dated in 1963, states the objective of the exercise was to, quote, eliminate a national security threat to worldwide peace, end quote. The people who urged Ricky White to tell his story did not dismiss the possibility that it is yet another assassination conspiracy hoax. Quote, my father was an individual that I loved and deeply admired, even today, White said, end quote. He declined to speculate on a motive for his father's actions, saying that he presumes his father was only following orders. He was told by our government to do something, White said. You don't question the government, end quote.
Why do you want to kill the president?
He was asked through Navy intelligence, which was a right wing of the CIA at the time, to eliminate a national security threat.
For decades, JFK researchers have chased the ideal of a confession, a mission log, or a government document that would finally reveal a coordinated plot. The alleged diaries appear to be exactly that. They include a first-person account of the events of November 22, 1963. They were supposedly written by a Dallas police officer that was on the scene at the time of the assassination. The diary claims CIA involvement in Kennedy's murder. Even though the documents weren't authenticated, the ideal of them was electrifying. The diary also tied together several elements that had long been points of speculation. A Dallas police officer with Marine experience, a supposed connection to Jack Ruby, a claim of CIA covert operations, and a three-shooter scenario. Researchers who already believed in a multi-shooter plot saw the diaries as a puzzle piece that made the whole picture click. Most conspiracy claims come from outsiders. This one came from Ricky White, Roscoe's son, who seemed earnest and emotionally invested. That gave the story a sense of authenticity, a human angle, and a built-in motive. A son trying to understand his father. Even skeptics noted that Ricky appeared to genuinely believe what he was saying. But by 1990, a large portion of the JFK research community already leaned towards CIA involvement, multiple shooters, and a Dallas-based operational team. The diary didn't challenge existing theories, they confirmed them. Confirmation is powerful. When a new claim aligns perfectly with what people already suspected, it gains traction quickly. The story had all the elements of a thriller. Secret mission, code names such as Mandarin, Saul, Lebanon, hidden documents, a mysterious death in an industrial accident, a son uncovering a dark family secret. It was the kind of narrative that feels too good to ignore, even if the evidence is thin. Adding to this, the diary surfaced in 1990, a moment when public distrust of the government was rising, and Oliver Stone's JFK was about to reignite the national interest in Kennedy's assassination. The Cold War just ended, making CIA stories newly fascinating. This cultural moment amplified the impact. The JFK assassination is a story full of missing documents, conflicting testimony, lost evidence, unresolved questions. The diaries offered something rare, certainty. Even if that certainty didn't hold up, the allure was powerful. In short, the diaries were appealing because they offered exactly what the JFK community had been searching for, a dramatic insider confession that tied together long-suspected threads. Even though investigators found them unreliable, the story itself had enormous gravitational pull. In the next episode, we will look at why Ricky White believed the story so deeply, and how the diaries were analyzed. And were the diaries eventually debunked? We'll see you next time. Those of you that have not purchased my book yet and would like to learn more about the assassination, drop me an email at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com and I will get you a personalized signed copy in the mail. It would make a great gift for anyone interested in the JFK assassination. It is an oversized coffee table style book that is over 500 pages and contains hundreds of pictures, most of them in vibrant color. I can promise you will not be disappointed in the book. The price is $60 for the hardcover and $40 for the softcover. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.